From RTE Radio, I'm Neil O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
I love this. It's Kafka-esque, it's challenging, it's...
I'm loving your Nicolas Cage impression.
Well, yeah.
Lorcan!
That's the way he pronounced my name.
Given how strong the players feel, I think it's really important now the delegates listen, because there'll be no change if they don't vote for this.
I hope in some small way, through Liveline and through RTE, we made people feel heard.
Coming up on this new Pope Day edition of Playback Daily. Look, I'm just a biochemist. What it's like to direct Nicolas Cage. The 1950s called The Scorts Controversy Heats Up. And Listen to Joe. Liveline presenter bows out after 27 years. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that's currently wearing Scorts in solidarity. And this morning's Oliver Callan monologue began with the scandal currently gripping the nation. Camogie players' dislike of wearing Scorts.
How quickly that unfurled in less than a week. The front page of the Irish Sun, you can stick your Scorts, and it is just talking about the heat of the controversy, saying that Camogie players planning another protest this weekend, like they did last weekend. Cork and Waterford both refusing to don mandatory Scorts for Saturday's Munster final as the rebellion heats up. And they were going to do this even if the match gets abandoned. And we don't know what's going to happen with that protest yet, because as you're hearing in the news, Well, look, you go back to that simple protest, Dublin Kilkenny Camogie players last weekend, and the extraordinary response it's had around the country and outside of it, and the pressure on the Camogie Association, whose rules mandate that they must wear this portmanteau of shorts and skirts, and they find it uncomfortable. 83% of the players have said that. There was a vote to retain the compulsory nature of the Scorts. And we forecast here, only because it was so blindingly obvious that there would be a managed climb down by the association and that there would be a climb down on the climb down. So you've heard there's going to be a special Congress with the Camogie Association in 2 weeks' time. That date was going to be next year, basically, 2026. So the association statement says it had proposed a deal with this issue at next year's Congress, but having listened to player feedback, we now recognise that waiting until 2026 is not acceptable for many. Although similar motions did not pass at the 2024 Congress, the association is committed to representing the voices of players who wish to have a choice in their playing attire. If the motion passes, the new rule allowing the option to wear skorts or shorts would take effect from the 24th of May 2025. Now, yesterday, in the initial climb down, that date was going to be 2027. So that is very significant indeed. And we'll be following that. Climb up on the lights. It's been hugely embarrassing for all concerned.
Well, it's hardly embarrassing for the players, is it? They've been extremely courageous in the face of some 1950s era nonsense from the Camogie Association. I mean, why is it even called Camogie and not hurling? Just because women and girls are playing it? Anyway, Oliver's not done with Scorts just yet. The issue made its way to the Dáil, as reported by the Irish Times' Miriam Lord.
She said it was unusual to see a couple of TDs in the chamber wearing shorts. In past times, the annual arrival of former Fine Gael TD Bernard Durkin in his Man from Del Monte jacket signalled the official start of the Dáil summer. It seems the new intake have a different way of doing things. Oh wait, it's more than two. Here's another pair of shorts. And another, and another. It looks like a coordinated sporting fashion statement, which it was, she says. And she points out, in fact, half a dozen Sinn Féin TDs wore shorts in the chamber when the Dáil resumed after the May bank holiday. And more of them besides in the Shannon. All of them women, which was disappointing, she says. If a few Sinn Féin men couldn't tog out in shorts to support the Camogie playing women of Ireland, surely they could have managed a few solidarity Scorts. And then she talks about the junior minister, Charlie McConlogue, representing the government on behalf of the issue. And she says basically that Charlie missed the opportunity to land, to take a stand on the Scorts issue with what is kind of indistinct speechifying. He didn't take a view at all. She said he needed a Scorts Earths policy. We actually had a lot of texts yesterday suggesting that the men playing hurling and football this weekend might show up in Scorts to show support for the women hurlers. But I don't see that been taken up somehow.
Shame. Alas, Oliver brought us news from the US during his monologue, which, let's face it, is seldom good these days.
The Americans are pushing nations facing tariffs to approve deals with Elon Musk's Starlink. This is an exclusive in the Washington Post, saying some countries have turned to the private satellite internet firm to ease the trade talks, according to details leaked from US State Department staffers. Extraordinary story. Lesotho in Africa has done a deal in the hopes it will, with Starlink, in the hopes it will ease negotiations to remove their 10% tariffs, which apply across the world in a 90-day window. And in India, government officials have sped through approvals of Starlink for broadband. It's satellites for broadband. It can bring it to remote places and so on. It is a brilliant company, to be fair, but there are extraordinary conflicts of interest. So they've sped through approvals of Starlink in India with the understanding that doing so could help them cement trade deals with the administration. The Washington Post reporting that Starlink's international expansion could unlock multi-billion dollar revenue streams. And there's an expert saying that's 1% of India's consumer broadband market would generate $1 billion every year, all to the private benefit of Elon Musk, who famously donated, what was it, $270 million to Trump's campaign, and he is set to exit his Doge agency at the end of the month to focus on the crashing fortunes of Tesla. But we'll watch what happens there. It's an amazing story. That'll go everywhere as well today.
The corruption is breathtaking. And there's so much of it, and it's so in your face that you start to become inured to it. Which is probably the point, isn't it? So the whereabouts of the First Lady is the next US topic under the Callan microscope.
Another figure in Trump's life, which is the focus of the most read article in the New York Times this morning online, where is Melania? So listen, read it this now. The lights never seem to be on, and the shutters stay shut. As the weeks pass by at the White House, the corner of the residence long used by the First Ladies remains dark. Because the First Lady, is she a vampire? No, the First Lady does not really live in Washington. Melania Trump vanishes from view for weeks at a time, says this New York Times piece, holing up in Trump's tower in Manhattan or in Florida where she can lie low at Mar-a-Lago. It's like having Greta Garbo's First Lady saying. Mrs. Trump is expected to appear in the Capitol today. That's why now they're thinking about her. She's going to unveil a postage stamp honouring Barbara Bush, the former First Lady, and attend a ceremony for military mothers. Actually, side note to that is George W. Bush, the most prominent of the Bush siblings, is not going to attend, such as his very shaky relationship with Donald Trump. But two people with knowledge of Ms. Trump's schedule said she spent fewer than 14 days at the White House in total since her husband arrived back there 108 days ago. Others say even 14 visits or 14 days at the White House is a generous estimate. That the First Lady's whereabouts is among the most sensitive of subjects in the White House only adds to the intrigue, because they fight back against everything, but they're not saying much about it. Every marriage has its highs and lows, but with so many other things, the Trumps are in a league of their own. In the span of a couple of months, they've endured a public trial about his philandering, two assassination attempts and a presidential campaign. And of course, Melania Trump kept well away from the courthouse in Lower Manhattan and from the campaign trail until the assassination attempt. But she did show up. She did an engagement on the 1st of April, a speech there. Then she came back a few weeks later and did the Easter egg roll at the White House with Donald Trump. And she went to Pope Francis' funeral with Donald Trump as well recently. When they landed back in Newark on a Saturday afternoon, it was Melania Trump's 55th birthday. The president gave her a peck on the cheek. She got into a car. He climbed into Marine One, that's the helicopter, and they went their separate ways. It's the New York Times, which is a media outlet hostile to Donald Trump, we must point out, for fairness and all of that, for sure, don't we?
Is it a media outlet hostile to Donald Trump? There's a lot of ex-subscribers out there who would question the wisdom of that remark. Certainly, it's a media outlet to which Donald Trump is hostile, but that's hardly the same thing, is it? Finally, for this monologue extract, Oliver has some handy conclave-related words for us.
Now, some words you might need to know as we head into these conclave hours with a vote due in 15 minutes' time in the Sistine Chapel. An expert in the papacy in Italy is known as a Vaticanista. Vaticanista, basically. And that's kind of journalists and academics, and they build up all their ties. So we'll be hearing from them as well. The Italian word that describes a cardinal favourite to become the Pope, a papabile. So if you're on the unofficial shortlist, head of the conclave, you're one of the papabiles, which is very good. The top contender, of course, alongside the Italian Pietro Parolin, is the English-speaking Filipino man. Very hard to dislike this man. He's dubbed the Asian Francis, presumably by his rivals to make him seem more liberal than maybe he is. Cardinal Luis Antonio Tagle. He's an all-singing, all-dancing cardinal. Very smiley man. Fluent in English, of course. He'd be great. Just give it to him already. The church is a conglomerate after all. It's all about growth. And an Asian pope would certainly achieve that. But in the Catholic corners of the internet, the song Imagine by John Lennon is going wildly viral. Oddly, it's more or less an atheist anthem, isn't it? But it's sung by Cardinal Tagle, or as we're calling him this morning, Cardinal Karaoke. Is he any good? Well, sure, we'll figure it out. Got some help on the high note there. Come on, Cardinal Karaoke, get to that big note. It's a no from me, Louis.
I don't know. He nearly did it. He nearly nailed it. It's okay for a cardinal.
He nearly got there. Oh, that's very good for a cardinal. It's very good. He's 67 years of age, which apparently might count slightly against him. I don't know why, because apparently Pietro Parolin is 70 and is the perfect age. But anyway, the odds are that the new pope, they get to choose their own name. And they can use their own birth name. Well, nobody has done that since Pope Marcellus in 1555. The odds are the new pope will choose the name Pius or Leo. It would be Pius the 13th. That seems unlikely. Or Leo the 14th. And for every pope, for nearly four centuries up to 1958, just six papal names were used. Clement, Pius, Benedict, Leo, Innocent and Gregory. And one name definitely ruled out is Peter, out of respect for the first pope, St. Peter the Apostle, and also because of a prophecy, isn't it? Not approved by the Vatican, that Peter II would be the last pope to serve if someone did it. John has been the most popular name for popes, with 21 popes choosing to adopt it, although confusingly, the last pope to actually take that name was Pope John the 23rd, because historians accidentally misnumbered the popes after John the 14th. So... don't count your popes before they're hatched. We're watching out.
Another thing for Oliver to add to his ever-lengthening watch list, and a spot at which we'll send up the white smoke in the shape of a flag to indicate somehow that the Playback Daily Oliver Callan monologue extract is over for another day. That low-key works, right? As we heard in Oliver Callan's monologue earlier, the Scorts controversy has exploded in a way that no one, not least the Camogie Association, could have anticipated. This morning, Claire Byrne brought in two experts to discuss where we are and what happens next. Cliona Foley, freelance sports reporter, and Ursula Jacob, former All-Star Camogie player with Wexford.
Ursula, do you welcome the announcement of this special Congress coming up now on the 22nd of May?
Yeah, I think it's a step in the right direction. I suppose some people are considering it's a win for now. And I think the big message that has went on the last week or so is, you know, that players' voices need to be heard. And I think the association, you know, have acknowledged that they need to listen to the players' feedback. And, you know, they recognise also that waiting until 2026 or 2027 is far too late to make a decision on this. I suppose my big concern, though, is still... what if there's a vote on the 22nd, you know, what if it doesn't pass? Because obviously we're still going to have the same delegates there representing each of the counties at this special Congress. So I think that's going to be an interesting point because, you know, they're who is representing the players, really.
Yeah, I think you're right to raise that because, Cliona, the Camogie Association makes that point in the statement today that a similar motion did not pass at the 2024 Congress. Do you think that that should be the watch point here, that this mightn't get through?
I would describe it as grey smoke as opposed to white smoke this morning, Claire, because
okay, they've made a sudden change. They're going to have a special Congress, but we still have to make sure that the delegates vote this through. And the last time this came up in 2024 at Congress, 55% voted against them having a choice, either skirt or short, and 64% voted against getting rid of skirts. So what's needed now is that given how strongly the players feel, they're prepared to go out, and this weekend the Cork and Waterford players are prepared to not play the Munster final if they're not allowed to wear shorts. Given how strong the players feel, I think it's really important now the delegates listen, because there'll be no change if they don't vote for this. There has to be voting for it.
Well, Ursula, do you expect that protest move from Cork and Waterford will happen now, given this development today?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one. And I think, there's still added pressure on the Waterford and Cork players, whether or not now, what's the decision they make? Do they hold off and wait and see? But I think they came out very strong, the last couple of days, and even yesterday, listening to Aisling Thompson and Niamh Rockett, you know, they're willing to, you know, put the game on the line because they believe it's not just for those players, it's for also future players. But just to kind of point back to Cliona's point there, I would actually call on the Camogie Association to use the next 2 weeks wisely in terms of, I think they should do a survey across the board of club and county players. That can be done. It's a 2 week time frame. Use the time now and get the views of the players and see what the overall feeling is, because as we've already mentioned, the delegates there that maybe represented him last year, there was a disconnect. So I think if we're really looking to see the accurate views of the players right across the board, I think there should be a survey done by the Camogie Association themselves, and use the next 2 weeks to plan ahead of that meeting.
Mm-hmm. So you're just concerned that the views of the players won't really be represented when that vote comes to pass. So maybe this protest, if it does go ahead at the weekend, will just serve to further reinforce the view amongst players that they want the option.
Yeah, I think...
Sorry, Ursula, if you go ahead there, and Cliona, I'll bring you in then.
Of course.
Yeah, no, I still believe that the girls should, go out on Saturday and wear their shorts. I think they've come out strong enough about it, and I think they should continue to go along with that message, because that's what they had said all week and even up to yesterday. And I feel a huge amount of sympathy for the players, even the referees ahead of the game at the weekend, because all eyes will be on that game in what action they take. Mm-hmm. And their focus should really be ultimately on a Munster final, but it's all been taken away by this. So I think it will be a big call from both Waterford and Cork in what they decide to do.
Okay, Cliona, what do you make of Ursula's suggestion now that the Camogie Association very quickly over the next 2 weeks get the views of players across the board on this?
I think it's really simple. Ursula's absolutely right. And in fact, if every club and every county board just said, we are going to take the next 2 weeks and speak to our players, call them in, talk to them, find out what they want, they could do it themselves. It doesn't. The imperative doesn't have to come from the Camogie Association. I think it should come from within the clubs and the county boards themselves. They know how strongly 83% of players in that GPA survey, their inter-county players, said they wanted the choice. But I do think they reflect the club players as well, that they want the choice to wear a skirt or a short. It's really interesting as well. I think a very interesting move during the weekend was a very brave move, was Dublin Camogie Board. Their referees said, if the players wear shorts, you tell them that it's not legal, but you continue the game and then you report it in your match report. So again, I think they added pressure as well, which was a really interesting move and quite a brave one as well.
Well, the Camogie Association has said now that if this passes and if there is a choice offered to players on the 22nd of May, Cliona, that it will come into force on the 24th, only 2 days later.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely brilliant, because that's a show of faith, if you like. Yes, if there's a vote for change here, we're going to implement it immediately. Whereas what they were doing was they were going to have a committee looking at this issue, bringing it to Congress next year. And then if passed, it wouldn't have been implemented until 2027. So that is a brilliant situation where they're saying, yes, if this is passed, we'll do it straight away. And I think that's what the players want to hear. It's not unprecedented, this. And actually, you could have a situation Clare, if passed, because it's to give them a choice that you could have players wearing skirts or shorts, depending on what they want. Mm-hmm. And exactly this thing happened in international hockey a couple of years ago. And a woman called Tess Howard, an ex-English player, really canvassed for the option to wear skirts or shorts. And she was successful. And actually, the English team in 2023 at the European Championships, for the first time ever, they wore a mixture of skirts and shorts. So you could possibly even see that.
Yeah, the Camogie Association in that statement talks, Ursula, about this working group established, it's already underway, to examine the comfort, fit, design and overall performance of playing wear. They say that will remain in place and continue to engage with players at all levels across the country. But what you're saying this morning is get that job done in the next 14 days.
Yeah, I think, as I've already said, I think using the next two weeks so wisely. You can be surprised how much you can get done in 1 or 2 days, getting the feedback from the players directly and making it inclusive, that it's club and county players, underage and senior players, not just getting a feel for, you know, a handful of players in each county. It can be easily done right across from the clubs and county boards, and it puts the onus and responsibility on them, because if this is a big, big decision to be made, well, everyone should be taking it seriously and using the next 2 weeks as wisely as possible.
Here's hoping. That's former Wexford All-Star Camogie player Ursula Jacob, along with freelance sports reporter Cliona Foley, talking skorts on this morning's Today with Clare Byrne. This afternoon's Liveline was a full-on display of why the show works so well, with a very important discussion of penile cancer, to bad behaviour at a David Gray concert, and one retired woman wanting to set up a drafts club. Having effortlessly guided us through all that, Joe went to a break and then came back with this bombshell.
After 37 wonderful years here in RTE and 27 years presenting Liveline, I just wanted to share a few words with you as I prepare to move on. First of all, it has been, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, an incredible honour and a privilege to be part of a programme that relied almost entirely on trust, the trust of our listeners. Listeners felt they could pick up the phone, ring Liveline, share their lives, their problems, their stories, sad, bad, sometimes mad and funny, their struggles and their victories. I never took that for granted, not for a single minute. Over these years, I've been blessed to work alongside hundreds of producers, researchers, broadcasting assistants and the wider public servants who make RTE. And when I say everyone, I mean everyone. Those who lift the paintbrush, wield the Black & Decker, a Hoover, operate a sound desk, from the person at reception to the person climbing a mast. We were and are all working towards the same goal, serving the public. And it goes without saying that my wife June and my three children, Sean, Ellen and Ronan, have been such a part of keeping me going day after day, often through difficult times on an intense daily programme. For that alone, I'm deeply privileged and eternally grateful. As the American poet Maya Angelou wrote, "People will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel." And I hope in some small way, through Liveline and through RTE, we made people feel heard. And now, after many happy years, I've decided the time has come to move on. I wrote to the head of radio last November, informing her that, having already extended my contract for 2 years, that Friday, June the 27th next, when it was due to expire, would be my final day on Liveline. As you know, and I've often said it, I know I'm not a firefighter or a paramedic or a teacher or even looking after young children at this stage. These are a street cleaner, a nurse, you know the list I always use. These are real, essential public servants and deserve all our praise and support. As my late mother used to say, Mabel said, "You're not to lose the run of yourself, you're just answering the phones." Well, I was trying to listen, trying to connect, trying to give people a voice, especially those without. Mabel, who died 2 years ago this Sunday, would have been 96. And on the day she was born, the Irish Parliament was debating the abolition of workhouses. We have come a long way. Like many of her generation who've been great Liveline listeners, remember, you dug the well and subsequent generations drank the water. As a country, a community, we've come an awful long way. Liveline began, as you know, under the great stewardship of the late Marion Finucane 40 years ago this year, and it will endure. So onwards, I'm looking forward to the next chapter. Please, please keep talking to Joe. I'm here till the end of June.
The presenter of Liveline for 27 years, Joe Duffy, telling us this afternoon that he would be hanging up his mic at the end of next month. What a career. The Surfer is the latest film from Irish director Lorcan Finnegan. Described by RTE Entertainment in its 4-star review as an ego-under-the-sun psychodrama, the film stars none other than Nicolas Cage. But, Oliver Callan wanted to know, when Lorcan dropped into studio this morning, how did the director get the legendary actor for the role?
I suppose we got lucky, really. The script was written by Thomas Martin. It was a very good script.
Another Irishman.
And we sent it to his manager, hoping that, you know, it was a bit of a long shot. And he sent it to Nick. And Nick, first thing actually he loved was the title. He was telling me just last week that he saw The Surfer. And he grew up in California. So he was like, oh, yeah, man, surfing. Yeah, I know that. And then he had seen Vivarium, actually.
Did he?
Yeah. He's mad into films. Like, he's like an encyclopedia of cinema. Mm-hmm. And then he went and watched Nocebo, another film of mine, and he was like, okay, yeah, this guy, I like him. And then he read the script, and he thought, I love this. It's Kafka-esque, it's challenging, it's...
I'm loving your Nicolas Cage impression.
Well, yeah. Lorcan! That's the way he pronounced my name. He just really liked the script and totally connected with it. And then we got on a call, and we got on very well. We're both into the same kind of films. Similar sense of humour, and it was a great collaboration then for the, you know, there was a few months of sort of back and forth, little tweaks to the script and stuff like that, and then once we got on set, it was all go.
What are your shared film interests with Nick Cage?
I mean, a lot of older films, a lot of, like, we both love The Swimmer, actually, which was influence on this film.
A lot of references in the reviews to it, yeah. It's
Bert Lancaster. Bert Lancaster a little bit. Yeah, there's a scene in the film where he kind of looks up to the house that he's trying to buy, and he's like, right up there on Clifftop Drive.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen that film, so that's what that little
right, okay, check it out. It's great, yeah. It's a very unusual film, but it's brilliant.
How would you describe, or how do you attract people to this film? I mean, it's like the stress of Uncut Gems, the Adam Sandler one.
It is a bit, yeah.
And what else? How else would you draw people to it?
I'd say it's like, on the surface level, there's like, it's comedy, it's action, it's... torment, it's psychological dread, it's all of the kind of fun stuff, and an amazing performance by Nick Cage. But then on another level, and there's all this, you know, there's these themes around masculinity and crisis.
Oh, yeah,
and
big time, yeah.
And all of that, and basically an incredible look at men's faces, I think, in the film. I actually asked Nick to grow out his nasal hair and his ear hair and his eyebrow hair and everything, so that he kind of uses face as a landscape.
His stubble is almost like his lips have disappeared. You know, this kind of strong beard growth.
Yeah. But so on one level, it's, you know, pure entertainment. On another level, it's, you know, an exploration into all this, and it's kind of existential and cerebral, and you can kind of pick it apart afterwards, some of the kind of more Jungian themes throughout the film.
A sign of a really good idea is that it's a simple plot to explain.
Yes. A man arrives at a beach. He tries to buy back this family home and that he, you know, he grew up in Australia, left when he was about 12, is returning in his 50s trying to buy back this home, and thinks that it's going to fix all of his problems with his marriage and with his relationship with his son. And it doesn't.
It goes horribly wrong.
Incrementally, he encounters the actual locals who are kind of ruling the beach down there and won't let him surf and won't let him stay there and just want him gone. But being a man and being stubborn, he decides, no, because I'm being told I'm going to leave, that I don't belong here, I'm going to stay here. And then over the course of about 4 days, he's sort of stripped of all his materialistic...
while living in the car park.
Yes.
And it's such a beach, it's like a universal beach, remote beach car park, isn't it? The filthy toilets.
Yeah.
One source of water, the cafe that may not or may open.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And then obviously down into the beach with the wilderness all around it.
It's a beautiful spot that we shot in. It was in Western Australia. This
what's the name of that little...
It's called Yallingup. That's very Australian.
Very Australian.
You're not making that up.
Close
AI
to Yammy
generator,
Creek.
Come up with Australian surf tan. Yeah. Yelling up.
Yells, mate.
Yeah.
How did they take to the idea that you were doing a locals-only, a kind of a violent locals-only surf beach? Does that carry on, go on in Australia?
Yeah, unfortunately, not that much. I mean, it does in some parts of Australia, like Sydney and Melbourne and stuff. And I was kind of hoping to encounter a little bit more localism while filming there. But everyone was just very nice.
They're very generous.
Yeah.
The Bay Boys is what the gang is called, which seems like a really innocuous name for a gang, a scary gang.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's described as more of an unofficial club. the cop in the movie.
The LA Times is saying this must be loosely based on an actual Californian group called Bay Boys.
Well, the Lanuda Bay guys, I suppose. I mean, it's basically this phenomenon in Lanuda Bay where in California there's this sort of crescent-shaped beach with these big modernist houses perched along the clifftop and very exclusive, very expensive area. And if you try and surf there, the guys will batter you.
Quite literally.
Literally.
And this trouble has been going since the 60s.
Yeah, but the thing is that they're not, you know, it's not like Point Break where these guys are, you know, tough surfer gang kind of guys. These are all like hedge fund managers and lawyers and bankers and stuff. So like during the day, they're buttoned up in their suits, you know, and talking to clients. And then when they're down on the beach, they turn much more primal and animalistic. And that's what sort of interested Thomas Martin in this idea of like, what is it about these guys? What is it that makes them become so kind of tribalistic?
Because he had witnessed something in Australia, as it happens, didn't he?
Something similar where he was in Sydney and he saw some surfers getting out of their wetsuits and putting on their kind of business suits. And suddenly they started fighting each other on the beach and like really violently, blood everywhere, you know, missing teeth, all of that. And in his mind, he was thinking one's like a lawyer and the other's a dentist. And like, what's the deal with that?
Yeah.
And that's when he kind of discovered the Lanuda Bay thing. And then he was also reading Robert Drew's short stories. He's like an Australian writer of fiction, you know, but he writes a lot of kind of interesting, weird stories around people in these surf locations in Australia. So I guess it all kind of got mashed up together and turned into the surfer.
In terms of the length of time filming, how long are you living in Western Australia for this?
I was there for 3 months in the end.
3 months?
Yeah. I thought I'd become an amazing surfer in that time, but making a film is kind of time consuming.
Do you surf yourself?
I have surfed. Have you?
Not at all. Wouldn't have a clue.
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult.
It's very difficult.
Yeah.
I can do the paddleboarding thing. What do you call the thing where you just lie on your chest and let the waves take you in?
Yeah, exactly. Boogie boarding.
Crash. Yeah, is that a boogie boarding?
Boogie boarding, yeah.
There are different names in Australia, are there?
Probably.
But I love how they have the money. They still have the waterproof money for surfing
purposes. Oh, yeah, yeah. Is that what it's for?
Plasticky
yeah.
water.
Yeah, very money. Plasticky money. It's impossible to rip.
Yeah, that's right. Why would you be doing that? And Nicolas Cage, he stayed in a famous surfer's house, I think, did he?
Yeah, there's a guy called Taj Burrows. He's like one of the top guys. And he rented his house, which is an amazing big house that looks over Yalling Up Beach. And that kind of helped us with the local surfers, sort of ingratiate us with them. Because we needed them
the
on side because we were shooting the beach the whole time. We needed, you know, we needed them to not disrupt filming if they didn't like us. We're not totally cleared. I mean, if they wanted to go surfing, we weren't going to stop them. And a lot of them ended up being in the movie and a lot of them ended up working on location, like, being assistant location managers.
Oh, really?
Yeah, all the locals were in the film. Like, we were quite remote. Yeah. So, like, even the owner of Caves Hotel, the local hotel, is, like, in the film. You know, this guy who sees Nick picking up this rat and he's about to bite out of it?
Yeah,
and he's holding
a fluffy dog.
Yeah, he's the owner of the hotel.
With the crew are all staying, obviously.
Yeah.
The interesting sounding shoot for Irish director Lorcan Finnegan's Nicolas Cage starring movie The Surfer, as discussed on this morning's Oliver Callan. The average wait time for a driving test in Ireland currently stands at 26 weeks. Some learner drivers who can't or won't wait are travelling to Georgia to get a licence that can, somehow, be exchanged for an Irish one. Today with Claire Byrne reporter Maura Fay brought us the story this morning.
A company called Driving License Urgent, which advertises mainly through social media platforms such as Instagram and TikTok, claims it can facilitate Irish drivers getting a license in Georgia within 2 weeks following last summer's bilateral agreement. A company representative who wished to be referred to just by his first name, Mika, told me that currently most of their customers come from Germany, Hungary and Ukraine, but now they're getting a lot of interest from Ireland. He explained to me how he himself got his driving license in Georgia.
For me, I was living in Germany back then and I needed it for a trip. So I went to Georgia because I've heard that you can get it relatively fast there. I already knew how to drive a car very well. So I went to Georgia, I got a motorbike license and a car license. Just doing, for a motorbike, there are two exams, theory and then like a practical exam. For car, there are three exams, so it's more complex. The theory exam can be taken in English, so that's a great benefit for someone who doesn't know Georgian, which is most of the world's population who are not coming from Georgian. It's a very complex language to learn, so you can take the theory test and all the tests in English, in Russian, in Georgian, obviously, and some other languages like Turkish, Armenian, the regional languages here. Then after you pass your theory test, you're taking the first practical test for the car. And this test consists out of six different elements. It's the backwards parking, like a 90-degree backwards parking in the garage, parallel parking, an eight, zigzag, like a slalom type of an exercise, and a three-point turn and uphill restart. So you basically stop the car on the hill, and then you restart to keep going. So these are not like the super easy elements, but also not too hard. So this test, people usually pass from like first, second, third try. They already know how to drive. And then the last part of the examination is the city test. And the city test consists of driving in the city for 30 to 40 minutes, depending on the route you will get. And there is an inspector, like a policeman, basically in the car who is there for safety reasons. But the whole exam is conducted by a computer. So the policeman just presses the start button and the computer tells you what to do, where to go, turn left, turn right, basically like a navigator. And the computer also counts the mistakes. There are sensors and cameras everywhere around the car and in the car. So they analyze every movement of yours. If you forgot to look across the shoulder into the blind zone when doing a turn, they will directly like stop the exam. So it's like a pretty strict exam, I would say. So from that perspective, it's a very fair examination system. There is no bribe here or corruption possible. So you really need to know how to drive very well. And in the end, if you pass this city exam in literally 20 minutes, you can pay an additional fee for like urgent printing of the license and you can already hold your license in the hand.
That sounds like a very high-tech test. Are many people availing of it? Many Irish people?
Well, we don't have any official government statistics on this, but Mika told me that his company has had approximately 20 Irish clients since the bilateral agreement was signed. An article profiling the service the company offers was recently published in District magazine, and following that, Mika says that they've had over 100 inquiries with a further 10 people signing up for the service. Mika explained to me how quickly people can get their driving license in Georgia and also the costs associated with it.
We have clients who arrive on Monday and leave on Wednesday with their license already. This is only possible, obviously, for people who already know how to drive very well. So they just need to take the tests and like they prepare in advance. And while they're here, they take the minimum recommended preparation. But like more of an average statistic for us is that it takes from, let's say, around 2 weeks to get it. And you could calculate two fails in two different tests. Because you can only retake a test in a week. So that's probably a big difference, that if you fail a theory or a city exam here for the car license, you need to wait at least a week before you can retake it, compared to some other countries where you basically go to the end of the list and you need to wait again for like 3 or 4 months until you can retake. So there is less pressure on the people who are taking the exam from my perspective. And then they have this 1 week to prepare again, and they have another chance of passing. Of course, they pay for like the urgent retake, which is around 80 euros to retake in a week. So on average, if you calculate that a person fails, let's say one time in theory and one time in a city exam, it takes around 2-2.5 weeks for them to complete, which is faster than most of the other countries. So if we calculate all the, like for an experienced person who already knows how to drive and they take the recommended classes to prepare for the exams, plus all the urgent fees, like to take exams in the fastest way possible, all the needed documents that the foreigner needs to prepare, all the like materials package and supporting the whole process with like us taking them to every appointment, helping with every step, is will be around 1K euros. Plus the flights and then booking or Airbnb to book the accommodation, but they're also very different price ranges there. Georgia is a relatively cheap country in total for like the food and accommodation. People will spend less than they would spend in any other European country, I guess, in the same period of time.
Yeah, but you are taking a big risk, because if you spend your 1,000 euro, you have to book your flights and your accommodation. So you add all of that up, and you're taking the risk that you do all of that and then you don't pass your test. That's the problem, isn't it? What's been the reaction to all of this?
Well, I queried it with a number of different groups. Firstly, the Department of Transport, who said, regarding Irish people obtaining driving license in Georgia, a valid Georgian license obtained legitimately through the Georgian licensing system may be exchanged for an Irish license under the 2024 bilateral license exchange agreement between Ireland and Georgia. The department also said that the Minister for International and Road Transport, Sean Cani, has instructed the Road Safety Authority to return to him this month with sustainable proposals, which will provide a faster resumption as to how it will meet the target of a 10-week waiting time for driving tests. The RSA themselves said, a person taking up residence in Ireland cannot drive on a Georgian driving license for any period of time and must exchange it immediately if they wish to drive in Ireland. The Georgian driving license authorities may have residency requirements to be satisfied before they issue the driving license.
Today with Claire Byrne reporter Maura Fay there with the story this morning on Irish learner drivers travelling to Georgia to get around long wait times for driving tests. Alcatraz Prison is in the news at the moment, thanks to the US president's curveball notion of reopening the facility that closed back in 1963. Don't look at the crashing stock market, look over there, Alcatraz! This afternoon, Ray Darcy spoke to historian and author Jolene Babiak, who actually lived on Alcatraz because her dad worked there.
What was the accommodation
like? No, they were apartment buildings mostly. Uh-huh. I mean, it was a variety. There was a big apartment building off the dock that had been an old army barracks and had been converted. There were three apartment buildings over on the other side of the island that were built in 1942. There was a duplex. There were four or five cottages. And then there were mansions up top left over from the military days. The warden's house, the lighthouse keeper's house, a doctor's residence.
Right. And was originally a military fort, Jolene?
Yes, to protect San Francisco from foreign invasion.
Ah, right. Yeah. So it's just dimensions, and how far is it from San Francisco?
Oh, in our terms, it's a mile and a quarter, so under 2 kilometers.
Right.
That's what surprises most people when they come to San Francisco, is that you can reach it, practically, you know, reach out and touch it.
Yeah. And what are the dimensions of the island then? How long is it?
Oh, wow. You've got me there.
All right.
Equivalent of, let's see, let me just think. It's probably the equivalent of about, you know, maybe a mile wide,
right, okay.
Or a mile long and
half a mile wide. I'm looking at it here.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. What was it like then as a child? Where do you live? I live in Alcatraz. Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, surprisingly, it was wonderful. There were 60 families, so about 75 kids were in residence. We all went to school in San Francisco, so we were off the island every day. And then we came back in the afternoon, and we all played together. Mm. You know, as one of my friends just said, you just went out on the old army parade ground, and you played with whoever was there. You know, so it was kind of democratic. You know, it was really wonderful. And the adults paid a lot of attention to the children and made sure they weren't in trouble and had lots of activities, particularly in the summertime when they were in school.
Yeah.
So it was a really close-knit community. And, you know, the fathers sometimes got involved in our games, and the mothers could watch from their apartments. and see that the kids were okay. So it was really, everyone loved it. There were, I could name three or four families that lived there for more than 20 years.
Wow. And what were the rules around fraternizing with the prisoners?
That didn't happen. The number one rule was don't speak to a prisoner.
Right.
Number two, there were no guns, no toy pistols, which in those days was pretty hard.
Yes,
because
you were playing cowboys and Indians, which is non-PC, but that's what we used to play.
And what was the third rule? Don't go into areas where you're not allowed.
Right. Okay. And did you ever encounter a prisoner?
I had an incident once when I was about eight, when a prisoner handed me a ball through the fence, making me the luckiest kid on the island that day. And it was done in the presence of a guard, and it was done pretty much wordlessly because, you know, when he handed me the ball as a gift, he had found this little handball. When he handed it to me, I immediately had a dilemma. You know, I was supposed to be polite to an adult, but I was not allowed to talk to a prisoner.
Right, so what do
and
you do?
And I remember that dilemma.
Smile, I suppose.
Yeah, so I doubt that I said anything. I probably just ran away and you know, looked back. And
you were saying that you had two stints out there. Now, I'd imagine when you were younger, you didn't really think about it too much, but when you were an older teenager, the thoughts that you were, you know, very close to people who were murderers, that might have been scary.
Well, murder tends to be a state crime. These men weren't necessarily convicted of crimes against women and children.
Right.
Those are state crimes. This is federal. It's mostly bank robbery, kidnapping, but in those days it was ransom kidnapping. You know, crossing state lines with stolen goods, anything that have to do with an interstate.
But you're saying that now as an adult and an historian. But
right.
As a 15, year old, there was a bad man just across the fence from you.
Yeah, the worst of the worst is what we used to say.
Yeah.
And I knew nothing about them and I knew nothing about their crimes and individually. Now, you know, the big difference between me living there as a child and then as a teenager was, as a child, that prisoners would wave at us and we would wave back. And that was cool. You know, that was exciting.
Yeah.
As a 15-year-old, I didn't look at them long enough to get their attention.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, famously, I mentioned Al Capone, probably the most high profile prisoner there. He was one of the first there.
Yeah, his early number. I forget now.
85.
Okay, thank you. 85, yeah. Yes. Yes, early prisoner. Dead by the time I was born.
Yeah. And they got him eventually on tax evasion, although his crimes were a lot worse than that, but that's how they got him.
Exactly.
And he'd been in another prison and then ended up in Alcatraz.
Exactly.
I read this, and you might confirm it because you've written four books on it. Did he play the banjo?
I think he did, and there were some recently, I mean, as many, in the last 10 years, I think there was some sheet music found that was attributed to him, yeah.
Right.
He played an inmate band.
And Machine Gun Kelly was the drummer, in what I read.
That I don't know.
maybe it sounds like a great story. It's a great yarn anyway, isn't it?
Yeah, I hadn't heard that one before.
And speaking of, go on, sorry.
No, Kelly was an interesting character because he had a narcissistic personality disorder that was pretty evident.
Go on.
You know, narcissists, as we famously know, lack empathy and have some moments of grandiosity, and they don't have any indication that there's anything wrong with them. And Kelly, in his case, involved, I think 21 people were convicted in his crime, and six of them got life terms, including his wife, her mother,
right.
You know, her brother. You know, so 21 people, that's an amazing feat.
He brought them all down with him. Now, you were there for the escape, which inspired the Clint Eastwood movie, Escape from Alcatraz. So when was that and what are your memories of it?
Now, that was June 11th, 1962. I was nearly at the end of my school year, but I had to go back to school, but the siren woke me up. And I was late for school that day. So it worked to my advantage.
That's historian and author Jolene Babiak talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon about her time living on Alcatraz. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, the weather is nice, so shouldn't we all be out in the garden knocking it into shape? On this morning's Today with Claire Byrne, gardening expert Marie Staunton shared her handy list of the plants you just can't kill, no matter how rubbish you are at gardening.
What is the beautiful thing, Mari, that you have
so
in front of
it's a butterfly orchid. Isn't it lovely?
It's really, very
really
nice.
Really different. So they hail from South America, up the mountains, mm-hmm. cooler kind of region with lots of cloud around and mist.
Oh, do they like it here then?
Well, they like it in a cool room, not too hot. They wouldn't get more than 20 degrees. Mm-hmm. And they don't like direct sunlight, so indirect sunlight. If I was putting that in my house, I'd have a little saucer underneath it with little pebbles, and I'd water in and around the pebbles once a week. And what happens then is the mist, the water kind of vaporizes and goes around the plant. So you're giving it what it would normally get in its own habitat in South America. So that's what you're trying to kind of imitate,
okay,
as it were.
So my orchid now, which was white, now it has turned a bit brown.
Yeah.
When I throw water on top of it, that's not a good idea.
That's not a good idea. Well, what you can do is once a week, with kind of not really cold water, run the tap and let the water go through the pot and out the other end. Once a week.
So they just want to see the water. Glance the water off it and gone. Yeah.
When you think about it, like even the Phalaenopsis ones, maybe the ones that you have bigger flower.
Yeah.
They're used to life hanging onto trees where they get drowned once a day. The water, they're in sunshine, but in kind of in the protection of trees. Water once a day falls from the sky, comes through the root system and goes.
Right.
That's
so they're
it.
Not really not absorbing drowned. It. They're just, it's just passing through.
Exactly.
That's all they want. So don't soak the orchid.
Yeah, I know. So don't, you see, just leave it alone. My mother's really good with orchids because she just ignores them. And then she remembers, oh, I better give that a bit of a water. And that's how to deal with orchids.
Right. So they're perfect for people like
just
me
kind of
and your mother.
Them. Yeah, exactly.
So we're going to talk about indoor and outdoor plants today. So the ones that are tricky to grow,
tricky.
What is top of your list there?
So a lot of questions I get are on Japanese acers.
They look lovely.
Most beautiful plants. But what people don't realise is they live life in dappled shade, and a little bit of sun, but dappled shade, in humus-rich soil that likes to free drain. They like a bit of moisture, but they also like not to be sitting in water all the time. So if you have one in a pot, which I see a lot of people buying, they're putting them in pots, they tend to be overwatered. They tend to be put on in full sunshine and maybe in a wind tunnel. Right, so they're the three things they hate. They hate wind because they're little, especially the very palmatum dissectum. That means that the leaf is really fine and feathery. And if it gets wind kind of burnt, they just shrivel up. And that's kind of the end
like
of the leaf. So they look awful. So they like, give them what they would not naturally get in their own habitat, which is the protection of other trees, dappled shade, moisture retentive soil, but free drains. So they don't want much. They just want quite a lot, actually. And then they'll be perfect. So if you're putting it in a pot on a balcony, put it in the shady part of the balcony where it gets a little bit of sun per day. Don't put it in the full sun. And never put an acer where you have a side entrance to a house. Usually I go in and I say, look at my acer. And I go, well, it's right where the wind is coming up through the tunnel of the side entrance of the house. So it's blasted out with.
And it doesn't like wind.
Doesn't like it.
And it's important to get those right because they're not cheap, those
They're
those
very
acers.
Expensive.
Yeah.
So you do your homework on stuff like that and try to imitate its natural kind of environment. Really.
Tree ferns as well.
Oh,
and
yeah.
they are
yeah.
beautiful
they're
looking
stunning.
Things when you get them right.
Yeah.
But not easy to get right, would you say?
Well, I tell you what they are. They're the total opposite to orchids. They require a lot of looking after in that they don't like to dry out. We get a lot of wind in this country, so they don't like to dry out. They are very much at home in New Zealand and Australia, where they're in, you know, I suppose in the bush, if you would. So protection of other trees, and they get a lot of moisture. So if you don't water the trunk part of that tree fern, then it'll dry out. And that's where the roots are. So it'll dry out really quick, go crispy.
Pour water over the trunk. Over the exposed trunk.
Yeah, exactly. So if you're directing a watering can, say you direct it right into the middle of the fronds. So the fronds are all coming out like that. Right into the middle. The water dribbles down the trunk, and that's the important bit.
And is that the one where you need a significant part of the trunk underground?
Yeah, so you need to stabilise it. So again, back to the wind situation. So if I put one into the ground, say you're buying a 3 foot tree fern, which are very expensive, about 10 inches of that is going into the ground.
Goodbye.
To stabilise it.
Gone.
Yeah, good luck. You know, and I always put a little bit of, I suppose, a little bit of a wooden stake, just small, into the side of it, in the hole, so that if it does rock, it has some little bit of support, because you don't want to see it staked. Mm-hmm. It would look ridiculous. You know?
Hydrangeas, you see them everywhere. They look lovely.
Yeah, no, they're brilliant.
But they can be fussy as well.
They can be fussy. So you have, you know, hydrangea incredible, and you have hydrangea Annabelle. And those ones are really, I think, a little bit easier than the others. Mophead are, you can't really prune the old growth or the old flowers off them in case we get frost. Where Annabelle, I can cut right back down to the ground, 6 inches off the ground or whatever it is in centimetres. And whatever growth it makes from there, it'll flower on. Mm-hmm. So they're easy enough. Even if you make a mistake, they'll still flower. Whereas the mophead ones, if you go down too far, you may run the risk of taking off the flowering, the bud that's going to flower for this year. Say you make a mistake with mophead hydrangeas. They're the old-fashioned ones, the big leathery leaves, and you cut it all back. It won't flower for you this year, but it will flower next year. And it'll probably flower better because you've reinvigorated it. You've given it a boost. So never fear with that.
And they're really worth it, aren't they?
Oh, they love them.
Glamorous.
Yeah.
They're gorgeous.
They're gorgeous, absolutely.
Will
gorgeous.
We come to some questions?
Yeah.
This listener would like some suggestions for plants in the bathroom with no sunlight at all. So I assume now we're talking about a plant there that you can't kill.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking at Sansevierias or stuff like that, you know, that really don't need a huge amount of light. Well, I mean, the old adage is, what is the an indoor plant is a plant that's dying slowly, you know, because it's not getting the light.
Very sad.
No, but that's the truth. I'm sorry to say, it's a plant that's dying slowly.
That you just mentioned there,
mother-in-law's tongue.
Oh, tall, narrow.
Yeah.
Leaves.
Yeah, real long.
But they can look quite dramatic.
They're gorgeous. And
nice,
they're very good in...
Despite the casual name of the
exactly.
Tongue.
We forget about the casual name. But if you have it in an office environment, they're really good for taking the negative vibes out of... And you know, just there's so much machinery around and that sort of thing. But you need a few of them. You can't just have one. So they'd be good. Anything like a cheese plant, all those ones are quite good. But in a bathroom, you're looking for smaller, obviously. So the likes of this orchid... Provided it was given some light per day, you could put it back in there in the evening. You know, that sort of way.
Move your plants around.
Move your plants. Oh, yeah. You know, exactly. Like you move a bouquet of flowers.
Not happening.
Yeah.
I
can't see you doing that, Claire.
I do it for 2 days and then I would completely forget.
Gardening expert Marie Staunton on This Morning's Today with Claire Byrne, giving good advice to all the not-so-expert gardeners among us. And that's all I have for you on this white smoke edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday with a whiter, smokier, pontifier look back at an entire week in radio. But for me, until the next time, thank you for listening and good luck.